which we'll be reading the Shabbos with God's help, is probably one of the most dramatic parashios that are found within the Chumash. The parasha begins with the prayers of Yitzchak and Rivka that they should be able to bear children. Rivka ultimately becomes pregnant and has a struggle within her that she does not understand. And upon questioning, she's told that she has two nations that will emerge from her. And as indeed we see born a Yaakov Avinu, who is an Ish Tam Yoshev Alim, one who devotes himself to Torah study. And his twin brother Esav, who's born first, is an Ish Yodei Atzayin Ish Tadeh, a person of the fields, a person who is one who is a hunter and who hunts down things more than just animals. We have the conclusion of the first section of the parasha, wherein on a particular day after hunting, Esav sells his birthright to Yaakov for some lentil soup. And that in itself is a fascinating understanding of what that whole interchange is about. The parasha then continues with Yitzchak's sojourn in the land of the Philistines, of Plishtim, where Gaza is today. And the end of the parasha is, and this is where the drama really comes in, Yitzchak Avinu calls Esav and says, I want to bless you before my death. Go out into the fields and prepare food for me so that I should become elevated on a high spiritual level in order to bring down the blessings from above. When Rivka hears this, she understands that her approach of Yaakov and Esav working together is different than Yitzchak's. Yitzchak really believes that Yaakov could be the one studying Torah and Esav could be the one supporting him. What we know as later known as the Yisachar-Zvulun relationship, where Yisachar studies Torah and Zvulun is the one who's in commerce. And that's how Yitzchak Mefarshim explained, the Malbim and others viewed his two children, that Esav would support Yaakov, and therefore Esav would be the one with the physical blessing. When Rivka hears this, she dresses Yaakov up in Esav's clothing, and Yaakov, as the Medrash says, almost crying and bent, goes into his father with trepidation, and basically concocts a story that he is Esav, he gets the blessings, ach yatzo yatza, he walks out of the tent, and some people say he only walks out of one part of the tent, he's still within the larger tent, and Esav comes from the field and says, here I am, where's my blessing? And the power in the story, the drama, when Yitzchak turns to him and says, what do you mean, where's the blessing? I just bless you. And Esav begins to cry, a bitter cry. And he says, it must have been your brother Yaakov who took the blessings, and he gives him the bracha of Al Charvecha Tichya, you will live by your sword. At which point, the end of the parasha, Yaakov has to get out of town ASAP, and he's given the ultimate brachos, which is the Birkas Abraham, the spiritual blessings which were never to be given to Esav, was only question of the physical ones. That's the parasha in summation. Of all that there is to choose from within the parasha, the one I'd like to spend the hour we have together is perhaps on the least famous and on the surface the least dramatic part of the parasha. And that's the middle of the parasha. When Yitzchak goes down and digs wells. And so often I think our knee-jerk reaction when we read such a section is, well, let's get into the good stuff. Who really cares if he dug wells or didn't dug wells? What's this all about? So what I'd like to try to understand today is what is the depth in Yitzchak digging the wells and what is this story supposed to teach us for our particular lives? The synopsis of what I'd like to deal with today is found in Source 1a. And all the wells that were dug in the days of Abraham, his father, were stamped by the Philistines and filled with earth. And Isaac re-dug the wells of water dug in the days of Abraham, his father, and he called them by the same names that his father had called them. So the Torah tells us that Abraham Avinu dug wells. These wells were covered up by the Philistines in the interim. Yitzchak comes back and re-digs the well. And 1b, where we have the more specifics, we find that it wasn't so simple the way these wells were dug. In verse 19, they dig a well, brimming over with fresh water. The shepherds of Gerar disputed with Isaac's shepherd, and they called this Be'er, this well, Esek, challenge. So Yitzchak's servants dug another well, it too was disputed, and they called it Sitna. And they dug a third well, And there, it was an undisputed waters, and it was called Rehoboth. Now God will grant us wide open spaces. And the end of this parsha is the fourth well of Be'er Sheva, which is the city that we know today, where there was a pact between Avimelech, the king of Philistines, and Yitzchak. So here we have a story, and I'm just mentioning it briefly, the whole chapter goes through it in detail, of Yitzchak and his servants digging wells, the wells being covered up and redug. Question we need to ask ourselves is, what is the significance of the digging of the wells? What is the significance in the fact that Avram's wells were covered up and that Yitzchak had to redig them? The approach I'd like to take today is to look at the story of the wells on two levels, two lessons, moral lessons for us to glean for our lives, and within each one of these lessons to then look specifically at the role of Yitzchak in his digging the wells. So just like last week, it will be two overall levels and then two levels, one level within the overall levels, so altogether four levels. I think the basis of what the wells are all about are alluded to in a medrash on this week's parsha. Let's take a look at the medrash in source number 2. The medrash asks, Kama be'erot chafar? How many wells were dug? So the two things, Rabbi Yehuda Amar Arba. Rabbi Yehuda states that there were four wells dug, the three that we mentioned at the end of the parsha, the fourth Be'er Sheva. What is the significance of four? Keneged Cain, corresponding to these four wells, Nasu Banav Arba Digalim Bamidbar. The Jewish people made four divisions, four banners in the desert. We know later on in Jewish history, when the Jews are traveling the desert for 40 years, they traveled surrounding the Mishkan, surrounding the tabernacle in the center, and the 12 tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh being split and Levi encamped right around the Mishkan, the 12 tribes were divided three on each side. So four sides of three, and each side had a degel, had a flag. So says the Medrash, says Rabbi Yehuda, the first opinion of the Medrash, we have four wells, and these four wells correspond to the four flags that were found in the Midbar. What does that mean? Connection between wells and flags, it seems to be a little bit unconnected, to say the least. Second opinion of the Medrash, the Rabbanan Amri, our rabbis have taught, Chamesh. There were indeed not four wells, but five, and they learn now that one of the wells was really not one well, but two wells found there. What is the significance of five? Keneged chamisha sifrei Torah, corresponding to the five books of the Torah. And here the Medrash goes through, which I would not like to do today, how each name of the well corresponds to a different aspect of each of the five books. For example, that the book of Shmot is parallel to Sitna, which is hatred, and that's the concept of the exile of the Jewish people. That's an example of how they're parallel. So before we even look at the wells, I'd like to say at the outset today that we are just touching the tip of the iceberg. There is a tremendous depth in these wells that we're not even going to touch on today. We're just going to get a taste of what these wells are about. What is the concept of the wells on a most general level before we deal with this medrash more specifically? So here in the Juggler and the King, again, Rabbi Feldman points out, source 6, there's a life-sustaining substance hidden deep beneath the earth, which, although it lies beyond the realm of human perception, man cannot live without. It is called water. A well is the connection between this hidden treasure of water and man. That which was heretofore concealed, unknowable, is revealed and placed within man's reach in unsuspected abundance. God is the source of life for the entire universe. He too exists beyond man's perception. Yet all the same, he wants man to have contact with him. For this purpose, he prepared various means by which man can experience a relationship with him, and these means are quote-unquote wells, which channel the precious life-giving revelation of divinity into the human soul. There are wells in time called the Shabbos and holy days, a well for the intellect called the Torah, and a well in a man-made structure called the Beis HaMikdash, the Holy Temple. And indeed, Nachmanides, the Ramban, learns all three wells as paralleling the three temples. And the language used for all three wells paralleling the times of the three temples at the ultimate temple to be rebuilt is Rehoboth, the type of expansion. A well, as we just saw, is something beneath the ground that is meant to be dug in order to be connected. That which is concealed, which we need to reveal. I'd like to develop this idea of the concealment that needs revelation in the writings of a Hasidic approach of the Shem Yishmuel. And this will be the basis of our shiur today. The Shem Yishmuel says the following. He quotes the Chovos HaLevavos on the verse in Proverbs, this is source 3, Mayim amukim etzam belev ish, v'ish tfunot yadlena. Just like waters are very deep, likewise advice within a person is found deep within a person's soul, and it's the wise person who knows how to reveal that advice. We all know that all of us have a lot within us, but it takes someone very smart who knows how to capitalize on that which is within us and be able to draw it out of the person in order for it to be utilized. Continues the Shem Yishmuel, just like this advice is hidden deep beneath, likewise, there is so much that is concealed from a person that a person is able to access in life. And then the Shem Yishmuel goes on, and this is the key point, and he says, second paragraph in 3, V'hainu shebemet, he says, you know, in reality, Hayat Sariah kol ish la'aliv et libo la'shem yifarach. You know, all of us should be so excited about God that we can't contain our excitement. But you know, he says, Ela sheyesh machzeh bifnei yanei libo. The problem is that we have obstacles in front of us. Just like the advice is deep within a person, so too there are obstacles that are covering a person. And this is the gashmias ha'olam, this is the physicality of the world, which is a mesech mavdil ha'mas'il milarot ha'tayyan ha'loki be'inav, which blinds the person, which conceals from a person godliness. So says the Shem Yishmuel the following. The job of a be'er, the job of the well, the job that our forefathers did by digging wells was to really create for us a structure on how we are to access that which is found deep beneath within us. That our desire within each and every person is a kirvas elokim, is a closeness to God. The problem is that there's so much blocking us from this relationship, that it's difficult to have this relationship. The job of a well is to dig beneath and below all of these obstacles to come to the point of connection. That's job number one, approach number one of wells. If just like the advice within a person is found deep beneath them and needs to be drawn out, likewise our desire for closeness to God is found deep within us and we need to draw it out. I'd like to try to develop this idea for a number of moments. This first level, that the wells represent the ability to come close to God, we just need to access it. Rav Wolbe and Alei Shur points out on the verse in the 30th chapter of Dvarim, which is found in Source 7, this mandate that I'm prescribing to you today is not too mysterious or remote from you. It's not in the heavens that one should say, let me go up to the heavens to reach it. It's not a course to see. Ella, rather, b'ficha b'vavcha la'sosa. It's within a person's heart and mouth to access Torah. So says Rav Wolbe, that's great news. Torah is close to us. It's not far away. Closeness to God is very easily accessible. That's wonderful. So says Rav Wolbe, if that is so, it's kikarov elecha davar. It's very close to a person. Accessing spirituality, coming close to God is so easy. So his obvious question is, well, how come we don't feel it? I mean, if you're in love with somebody, so when you're having this communication of love, you're not distracted by a zillion things because you're in love and you're just expressing love. If we were so in love with God, then how come when we pray, we're distracted by a zillion things? That clearly does not show closeness in love. I don't know what it shows, but it's not closeness in love. So ask Rav Wolbe, what is it here that we don't feel this closeness to God that we should be able to, as the Torah describes? So he says, first we need to understand what the closeness is all about, and then we can understand what the distance is all about, and then we can understand how to work on overcoming the distance to the closeness. So he says very briefly, what is the closeness all about in sources 9, 10, and 11? He quotes the Ramchal, who says that the Torah is a light that is given to each individual. And unlike secular disciplines, which is intellectual knowledge for intellectual knowledge's sake, Torah is meant to change the person to bring about a fire within a person that it's not only intellectual knowledge, it influences them as who they are. The example that we've brought a number of times here, but it remains true every time we bring it, is the famous example of the college professor who taught ethics, who did not lead an ethical life, and when called on it by the school board, this is not appropriate, an ethics professor should not be an ethical person, his response was, would you expect the math professor to be a parallelogram? And just like you would not expect him to be a geometry figure, how could you expect me to be an ethical figure? Torah cannot be just an intellectual discipline. It has to be something that's going to speak to the individual as an individual, a fire that's going to light within the person. In fact, Rav Wolbe quotes that there are, for every individual, that approach of understanding Torah. The Torah is just not one approach, but rather each individual, who they are, has their understanding of Torah, their approach to Torah. That's what Torah means. It's so close to us. Each person has their ability to understand Torah that's significant for themselves, for their understanding. And he compares it to a coal, which is burning hot, that all you have to do is blow on it, and it's going to ignite. Our problem is we leave it just with a glimmer of coals, and we don't fan the fire and make it hot. Why not? What is the distance that we have within us? So here Rav Wolbe offers an interesting perspective on our good friend, the evil inclination. Someone we all know very well, that's why I call him a good friend. And he quotes the Talmudic statement in the Gemara and Shabbos, which is found in Source 12. It's a very famous statement. Hamekareya begadav v'chamato, one who rips his clothes in anger, or hamashabir kelav v'chamato, he breaks clothing in anger, whatever a person does in anger. Yehei beinecha ke'oved avodah zarah. It's as if you should look at it as if the person is worshipping idols. Why? Because today this evil inclination is telling him to do this, and then tomorrow will tell him to do that. And sure enough, if he's going to listen to all this, he's down the path toward worshipping idols. And here, the Gemara quotes a very famous understanding of the verse, which talks about not having idols within your possession. The verse says, Lo yeh b'cha elzar. You should not have within you, in your midst, a foreign god. V'lo tishtachavel el nechar, and do not bow down to a foreign god. So here the rabbis explain, what does it mean? You should not have, Lo yeh b'cha elzar. You should not have among you a foreign god. It's b'cha, literally, you should not have within you a foreign god. And what is this foreign god within a person? This is this element of the Yetzer Hara. This is this element of something that exists within us, which creates a separation from ourselves. And here Rav Wolbe says, and I think if we're honest with ourselves, we know it to be true. He says, if a person has negative character traits, what they are doing is distancing themselves from themselves. A person who's a Baal Gaiva, who's a very haughty person, is really not in contact with reality. We, as observers, know that. But we say, let's get real. Like, find out who you are. Where you really see this, he points out in Source 14, is when a person gets angry. And I'm sure none of us here have ever experienced anger, but perhaps you've seen it in another person, what anger is all about. Or maybe you've seen it once or twice in yourself. After a person calms down from this angry fit, they normally say to themselves, I can't believe I did what I did or said what I said. I lost complete touch with reality. When a person gets angry, and anger is just one of a multiple amount of character traits, they lose sense of self. The loss of sense of self is this Elzar, this foreign god that resides within us, and it's this foreign god that creates the distance, the richuk, within a person. So the Torah is this coal, Torah is this fire, it's this light that is really able to illuminate our souls. The problem is that we fan, or we create a blockage with this fire by creating this entity called the monster of self in a person. What's the way to fix this? So he says that the obvious answer is to work on one's midos, work on one's character traits. And he says in Source 17 that our rabbis have listed in the sixth chapter of Pirkei Avos of Ethics of Our Fathers 48 ways in which the Torah is nicknamed, the Torah is acquired. And if a person works on all 48 ways, it's the ability to listen, it's the ability to have understanding, to have patience. The 48 ways listed, one can look them up in the sixth chapter. If one works on all 48 ways, then what one does is works on one's character perfection, and through character perfection, you come back to self, and coming back to self brings you back to a level of Torah. And here Rav Wolbe concludes this essay by saying, there's a beautiful medrash in Shir HaShirim Rabba in source 18 which says, Mayan ganim be'er mayim chayim. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan stated, Mem chad pamim katu batara be'er be'er. The 48 times in Torah that the word well is used, kinegin memchad dvarim shenitna bam Torah, corresponding to the 48 ways to acquire Torah. Rav Wolbe then says that one who works on each one of these pathways of perfection of soul is really digging another well, another aspect of coming in contact with who one is, breaking through all the barriers, and coming to a level of perfection. And that's why he says we can understand the pasuk in this week's parasha that Avraham Avinu kept the entire Torah. How could he keep the Torah? He didn't have the Torah. It says Rav Wolbe, it's a mistake to think, I'm summarizing source 20, and it's a mistake to think that Torah is only learned from books. Yes, Torah is an intellectual discipline, don't get us wrong, but it's not only learned from books. The way to have Torah being acquired by a person is a two-pronged process. One is the learning process, the reading, the studying, and the other is working on self. Amram Avinu was able to work on himself to be acquire all 48 ways so that Torah became part of him who he was. Because when you connect to self, you're really connecting to Torah. And that's why it's Rabbi Elazar ben Arach whose quality is a mayan hamitkaber, an overflowing spring, is the one that says the best midah, the best thing to a person to have is a lev tov, is a good heart. It's a fine quality trait which is represented by the concept of a well of digging through that leads a person to spirituality, to Torah. How is this so? How are character refinements the prerequisite for acquiring Torah? So here I'd like to briefly go through an idea that's found in Rabbi Kagan's book, The Jewish Self, which I mentioned a number of weeks ago, that I can't but highly recommend. And he says, and I'd like to go through a number of his ideas. Our awareness of the spiritual creator, however, does not begin from looking out at the creation. First, we sense it, and the it is capitalized here, the it being spirituality, the it being God, the it being the divine, within ourselves. Only from there can we recognize its expression in the world around us. It is not merely our awareness of the Creator which comes from within us. The Creator's actual connection to His creation is focused through man. He was specifically created for this purpose. So God's revelation to man starts within man, and therefore man's understanding of God will start from within man himself as well. To this end, he was made of a godly soul combined together with a physical body. Our humanity lies with these two elements meld into a single whole. We experience this as our personality and character, and this is a beautiful idea, that our personality is really the combination of the godly soul and the physical body. When we peer through our character toward the inner recesses of ourselves, we find an infinite, bottomless depth. This opens towards the Creator Himself, the root of our most essential self, because by looking through us, we come to reach that divine soul from which we were created. The elements of human character are the true medium of contact between the realm of the spirit and the realm of measure and boundary. Thus, the term midos used to denote the levels through which spirit passes as the it approaches physical reality also means humor, character traits, and those are the seven midos which God reveals himself to this world. Continuing in 23, on a deeper level, refined character is the primary conduit of our connection to spirit. It is only when we ourselves embody his refined characteristics that we constitute a clear path along which spirit can travel into creation. When we express refined characteristics, we are actually expressing godly characteristics through the medium of ourself. The Creator is expressed in the world through us, and we cleave to Him like a branch after its root. And he says so beautifully, he says, if we understand that this is what life is all about, that we're created as a meld between the divine image as well as between the physical body, we can understand the struggle that lies within a person. And he speaks about this is the point of why one studies Pirkei Avos, Ethics of Our Father 24, because Avos is dedicated to the refinement of character as a vehicle for the expression of the spirit that lies within us. Character requires refinement because while it originates in spirit, it also has a root in the physical realm. Character can be drawn towards its physical root, become self-absorbed, and block out spirit rather than becoming its platform. When purified, however, the independence of the physical root is nullified, and character is cleansed of obscuring selfishness, allowing spirit to shine through. And he says so beautifully in 25, just as character expresses spirit into physical existence, our individual character provides a window which opens towards the realm of the spirit. It is this opening which allows us to sense infinite being when we gaze within. And that's why he says in 26 that it's only a prophet has to pass through this stage of refinement of character traits in order to get prophecy. You can be the most brilliant person in the world, but if you're not going to have refined character traits, you will not be able to get prophecy. Because, and this is a very beautiful idea, that it's only through the refined character traits, which really represents the divine element within us, that we have the ability to go beyond our character of who we are and look into the divine within ourselves. And that's why he says in Source 27, we cannot see in the Torah more than what exists potentially within ourselves. The Torah does not create in us what is not there. It is only a helpmate to aid in our actualization of ourselves. Either the Torah can provide a platform from which we reach beyond this world, or we can read it in such a way that we cut off even its connection to transcendence. If we have refined our characters to the point where the potential for connection is in us, then our study of Torah will open that connection. If, on the other hand, we are cut off from the transcendence inside ourselves, we will project that breach into Torah itself. So when people say that they don't feel connected to Torah, it's not Torah that's not connecting with you. It's an individual not connecting with their character traits, which thereby does not allow them to connect to Torah. The Torah is a helpmate allowing a person to reach transcendence. One needs to perfect oneself through character traits in order to reach the divine element within self. In doing so, one is able to comprehend and apprehend Torah. And that's why, in conclusion, in 28, the only channel through which we can reach transcendence is our character. Regardless of whether a specific vehicle is prophecy or the Torah, the channel will always be through our refined character. So this is the first level that I'd like to present for the morning, and that is that the wells represent digging beyond ourselves so that we refine our characters, that we are in touch with selves, and in so doing, we are in touch with the concept of transcendence of the divine. Within this level, let's look at Yitzchak Avinu specifically. Yitzchak Avinu is involved in redigging the wells of his father, and here, the Emunat Itecha Rav Moshe Wolfson explains that the wells that Yitzchak was digging was really a well of connecting to God. It wasn't just a well of water. He says in Source 29, V'hinei inyan chafirat ha-beirot, the whole concept of the digging of wells, hi hamshachat ha-emunah, it's really bringing out the concept of emunah, the concept of belief in God. He be'er nikra emunah, as we find in a number of places, a well is a reference to faith. And here Rav Wilson says the following. Avraham Avinu brought the concept of monotheism into that whole region. The Plishtim came along, and as the verse say, they were sitmum, they covered up the wells. And as the Kutzker Rebbe explains, the word sitmum comes from the word stam, simply. Plishtim Pashtim, as we'll see in a moment, represented the concept of leitzanus, the concept of scoffers, where they made fun of things. No big deal. You don't need Amunah. Yitzchak then had to come along and re-dig the wells that Avraham dug and say, no, Amunah is a big deal. Don't make light of it. We need to make sure that this is a fundamental belief within the world. Rav Wolfson explained, then had to come along and re-dig the wells that Avraham dug and say, no, Amunah is a big deal. Don't make light of it. We need to make sure that this is a fundamental belief within the world. Rav Wolfson explains the following on the next page. I'll just summarize verses 31 through 36, where he says that we are products of Aristotle, and that philosophy which says that we only believe in that which we can prove. We take that as an axiom, that you only believe in things that you can prove. That is because that has been handed down as Western civilization. Judaism holds that one can believe in things that one cannot prove as well. And this is really the debate that was going on in terms of Yitzchak and Abraham digging wells as a concept of Amunah, a concept of faith. And the Plishtim, which is represented by Leitzanus, represented by scoffers who said, no big deal, you don't need faith, you can't prove it, who needs it? And it's not accidental that the first Rashi in our parsha begins off with this Leitzanus, the scoffing of the Plishtim. The first pasuk says, these are the Eila told us Avram, Avram Halina Yitzchak, these are the offsprings of Avraham, who's Yitzchak, Avram had Yitzchak, why do we need this emphasis? The Rashi brings down is that the Plishtim made fun of Sarah and said, you think that you got pregnant from Avraham, give me a break. You were taken by Avimelech, clearly you had the child from Avimelech. This is the nature of the Plishtim, to make fun of everything, to make light of everything. Yitzchak having to go to the Plishtim was to create the spirit to counteract this force in the world, so to speak, and to create this concept of Amunah, of attaching oneself to God, to the source. How does this connect with the four degolim, the four banners that were found in the desert? Right? We saw that the first approach of the Medrash is that this concept of the wells correspond to the four banners of the Jewish people in the desert. So here, the Shemi Shmuel explains in source 37, what is a banner all about? So he says, in the middle of 37, D'inyan ha-digalim kamo begashmiut, she'eda ha-toemin ha-machane la-shuva machaneu binakel. It's a point of reference. You know, when a person's lost, they always look for a landmark. And when they see the landmark, they know exactly where to go. The digalim, the major flags in each of the four camps, was a landmark for the person who got lost wandering in the desert. Sometimes they just set up camp. You might have gotten lost. Zillions of people flying around. Where's my tent? No problem. You would look up at the degel, you would look up at the flag, and you know exactly where your tent is. The degel, the flags, marked a place for a person to be drawn to know exactly where their place was in camp. On a deeper level, 38, World Mask, Rabbi Tatz, when the Jewish people traveled through the desert, they traveled in formation, the Diglei Midbar, or flags of the desert. Each tribe occupied a specific position within the camp. The root of this formation lies in the fact that each tribe has a specific identity and a function within the Jewish people, and therefore a specific place. Within each tribe, each family has a specific and unique role, and so too each individual within each family. So the flags on a much deeper level really represent a person knowing where they stand in life, a person knowing their own identity. Now we can understand the first part of our Medrash so beautifully. The wells really are parallel to the flags. And just like the flags represent a point where a person knows exactly where they stand, they know what makes them unique and special, that's the role and the job of the wells, to dig within a person, to dig within self, to clear away all the obstacles, have character refinement so that a person knows exactly where they are and has the ability, like going toward the flag, have the ability going back toward self by digging the wells and coming back to the source. That's level number one. Let's do briefly in the time remaining level number two. Level number two of what the wells represent is found also in the Shem Yishmuel. And he says, "Dinei davar chidush hagarem hitpalut v'regesh hanefesh im hadam yatmid v'yeragil." There's a big challenge, a big obstacle in life, is that when a person becomes accustomed to something, that they lose enthusiasm, they lose this hislavus in doing something. He says when the forefathers dug the wells, their biggest concern was when the Jewish people will have Judaism as second nature to them, whether they've grown up in a from family or they've come to Judaism as a later date, no matter what, it becomes almost a routine part of their lives. And what will happen they were afraid of is that people will lose the freshness and the excitement that they should have for doing Torah and mitzvot. Lighting Friday night candles every Friday night should be a spiritual experience. Any mitzvah we do should be a spiritual experience. The digging of the wells is a representation of the flowing wells that just like the water constantly flows, likewise our feelings toward the water, which is represented by Torah, should also be new, should also be exciting, should also be alive. To dig the wells is on this level symbolic of digging with enthusiasm over and over again the Torah that we're involved with. And this, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz HaTzal explains in Sichos Mutzer, is the big reason why we have this distancing from God. It's because we've run into a life of inertia, pattern, and habit. And when things become habitual, you lose the feeling of closeness. You get very comfortable with somebody. So when, you know, getting part of a relationship, you're very careful what you say and how you say it and how you look. But already when you're comfortable with the person, so all that just fades away and you're just yourself. Whatever that may be. Sometimes good, sometimes not so good, but be that as it may. There's a danger in that. And that's the danger that we have when we're so close to something, we just take it for granted. And here he brings down another essay, a very fascinating idea. He says there's a pasuk in Yecheskel that the Chassid Yavitz brings, and this is source 43, where in the future times, Yecheskel tells a person that when you enter into the temple, those who enter into the northern gate have to exit by the southern gate, and those who enter in the southern gate have to exit in the northern gate. You cannot exit the same way you enter. Why not? Explains the Chassid Yavitz very beautifully. He says, if you walk in a certain gate, and then you walk out of that same gate, you're going to look at that gate as just an ordinary gate. And when you get home, you're going to look at the gate in your house just like that gate in the temple. It's going to lose the concept of holiness of gate. If you only walk through it once, so it maintains an experience of walking through the gate into the temple. Already twice, it's lost that specialness. And this, says the Sichos Mutzer, it happens to be reality in life. The more we do something, the more routine it becomes, and the more of a challenge that we have in order to express this enthusiasm. And this is what Rabbi Cardoso speaks about in his book, Between Silence and Speech. He says, this is the beginning 45 of all genuine religion. Because of man's astonishment with the world and himself, he recognizes the masterly hand of God. He ponders over the grandeur and sublimity of God. When seeing God as the foundation of all mystery, he starts to feel him in his bones. As been said, the tendency to take everything for granted and the indifference to the sublime is the root of all the religiosity. To be aware of the total mystery of all matter, to feel it, to breathe it, is obviously not an easy task. How does man capture a notion of wonder and amazement and inject this into his very life? So he explains, this, the author would suggest, is only possible by capturing the mysterium and transforming into a way of living. And this is the purpose of halacha, to experience the mysterium in and through commonplace deeds. Halacha is the art of revealing the non-human side, the meta-human side, the divine dimension through the medium of every human act. By giving deeds, 41, 49 really, a divine direction, they become sensitized to the notion of mystery. By living halakha, Jewish law, we hold back and allow for a moment of reflection. It creates a mindset not to take anything for granted, but to become amazed. What halakha should do, and it's a challenge for us, is to say, let's not take life for granted. Let's appreciate the apple that we eat. Let's appreciate the fact that we're able to go to the bathroom. Let's appreciate small things in life. Let's stop for a moment. Let's reflect. And if one reflects, then one will be able to build within oneself this concept of enthusiasm. The reason why we don't have it is we don't stop to think. How many times we say a blessing over an apple, and then after we said it, we ask ourselves, did I say it? Did I bench? Did I do all these things? Why? Because we're an automatic pilot. If we would hold that apple in our hand and say, wow, what a blessing, an apple. Wow, let's think about this apple. Where did this apple come from? You know what this nutritionist apple has? You know what a gift this apple is from God? If we would just focus on this apple, but for what? 30 seconds. That's all we're asking for, is 30 seconds on this apple. Well, this apple is not just a simple apple. And this blessing is not just a simple blessing. And now they're able to take a mundane action and elevate it to a higher level. And in so doing, I've redug the wells that our forefathers are trying to dig. I'm able to take that enthusiasm, that freshness, and constantly be having ever-flowing, ever-fresh water of Be'er Mayim Chayim. If that's the overall level of the second level of finding this freshness and newness within Yiddishkeit, we have this specifically within Isaac, Yitzchak Avinu himself. Yitzchak Avinu was given the tradition from his forefather, Abraham. And he was given a tradition, and what he said was, it's not enough for me just to take the tradition. I need to find myself within that tradition. I need to define my own personality. I'm not just going to become a passive vessel. I need to make something of myself. Let's try to understand Yitzchak in this light. 50, the Inside Story, edited by Rabbi Tauber, the writings of Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal. Therein lies the key to the enigma of Isaac. Isaac was awe to Abraham's love, restraint to Abraham's expansiveness, self-effacement to Abraham's self-assertion. Abraham's love of God and humanity took him on a journey from self outward, a journey etched in the roads of Mesopotamia, Egypt, and Canaan. Isaac was an inner journey, a journey into the depths of self, to the essence within. Isaac is the fear of heaven in the Jewish heart, the Jewish self-centering discipline, his silent sacrifice, his humble awe before the majesty of the Creator. Isaac was a digger of wells, boring through the stratum of emotion and experience in search of the quintessential water of the soul. Boring deeper than feeling, deeper than desire, deeper than achievement to the selflessness of the core of self. And this was very necessary. Why? Because in 53, as long as Abraham was alive, only pure love flowed from his righteous wells. But after his death, the Philistines commandeered the fountainheads of love he had established in the land. The Hebrew word plishtim means open-ended one. A plishtim love is an uninhibited, undisciplined love. It was Isaac who redeemed Abraham's legacy of love. As redug by Isaac, Abraham's well became immune to Philistine corruption. For love that flows from a well of selflessness and fear of heaven falls faithful to its source and true to its objective. Why did Yitzchak have to redig the wells Abraham dug? It's much deeper than that. Abraham's wells represented chesed love. What does it mean the Plishtim, the Philistines, covered up the well? It means that they took this concept of love and used it for self-love. They took this concept of generosity and used it and perverted it in terms of self. As we spoke a number of weeks ago, the model of Noah's generation. Therefore, Yitzchak had to come and redig the wells and to tell you no, that this love has to be channeled. This love has to have restraint, and that's what it means that Yitzchak redug the wells of his father. And he concludes this essay in 54, every Jew is a child of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We have their DNA in our soul. The Abraham and the Jew rushes to embrace the world, to champion its downtrodden, to extend himself, heart, soul, and checkbook to his fellow man. But love, to be true, must be restrained. The father who embraces a child with the full intensity of his love will hurt rather than comfort him. And love unchecked eventually disintegrates to destructive everything goes, quote-unquote, love of the Philistine. Isaac is the Jew's source of discipline, humility, and reverence, of its appreciation of the nullity of finite man before the infinity of God. And clearly, who we're not speaking about today is Yaakov Avinu, who's able to combine both in the Midah of Emes, the Midah of Truth. Now I think we can understand what the Medrash means, that this corresponds to the five books of Moses. Here again, the Shem Yishmuel points out in 56 that that's what Torah is supposed to represent for us. Torah is supposed to represent finding ourselves within Torah as a new discipline, as not something old. That's why the Shemesh Shmuel says, we say in our blessing of the Torah, that God is no Tein HaTorah. He gives the Torah present form, not Natan HaTorah, He gave the Torah. Every day we need to look at it as the Torah is given. Every day we need to find out within ourselves our relationship with Torah, a newness with Torah. He quotes the famous Gemara and the famous Mashal that we need to look at Torah as a young baby who nurses from its mother. That they constantly nurse and they constantly find nourishment and food, and it's an experience wherein the more they nurse, the more nourishment that they will get. And if that is our view of Torah, that we're looking at it as a young child who wants to nurse from its mother, who wants to gain that nourishment, we will find that nourishment. And not only find that nourishment, we're creating more nourishment and more nourishment. It's the Mayan HaMitkaber, it's the well that's overflowing. Let's summarize the ideas that we've seen, and I'd like to conclude with one more. The first level of the digging of the wells is the concept of character refinement, of digging past the obstacles that happen in a person to try to reach the essence of self. And this is key and crucial in the study of Torah. It's not only book knowledge, it has to be character refinement. You know, it reminds me very briefly of a story that I read in one of the Magid books of two boys that came to be tested right after Sukkot to be able to enter into a very prestigious yeshiva. And the Rosh Yeshiva, the head of the yeshiva, tested both boys and accepted one boy and did not accept the other. And people asked Rosh Yeshiva, with all due respect, Rosh Yeshiva, we're not challenging your ability to discern, but this one boy who you rejected is supposed to be, I mean, Louis is supposed to be brilliant. And the boy who you accepted, he's not stupid, but he's like an average type of person. Why didn't you accept the other boy who was brilliant? To which the Rosh Yeshiva responded, said, I'll tell you. He says, when the two boys were coming into the yeshiva, I was sitting by, learning by the window, and I saw them coming in. And there happened to be schach, which is the branches from the top of the sukkah, when the sukkahs were taken down, so the branches were left on the street. So they were around on the street. The boy who was brilliant stepped right over the branches and came into the yeshiva. The other boy made sure to walk around and not to step on them. That's the type of boy I want in my yeshiva. It's not only the book learning, it's the sensitivity. If you're going to be sensitive even to the branches that are no longer used for the holidays, you have a person who has sensitivity to people as well. That's the person who's opened up the wells within them, who's going to be able to learn Torah and able to have the character refinement to become the person who's going to want to learn. The second level is the level where we need to understand that it's a constant flowing of water, that we have to look at Torah as not old, humdrum, but rather something new, something exciting, that there's an enthusiasm for Torah, that we feel this closeness to God, that we want to develop, that we have that same desire as a young baby that nurses from its mother. I'd like to conclude with one last idea, again from Lubavitcher Rebbe in Likutei Sichot 55. One may argue, I've tried digging once and twice, and I see that it's useless. In fact, the Philistines have taken away the wells. How then can one consider to dig further? Thus comes the answer, the lack of success until now is a concern of the Almighty, and what have you to do with the secrets of the All-Merciful? As far as you are concerned, you must dig and dig until you reach the living waters, and ultimately you will achieve that last well. The Eternal has made room for us, Rechobot, and we shall be fruitful in the land. And I think this is the final motto, perhaps, in this parsha, that the first two times that Yitzchak dug the wells were taken away from him. And I think this is a very important concept for us to keep in mind when we're digging, that it's not such an easy process that we'll dig and we'll find gold and we'll immediately access ourselves to that which we're looking for. The first two times he had to give back the wells. It was only the third time, out of much effort, concerted effort, that we have the concept of Rechobot, the concept of this expansion. And I think we need to keep that in our mind, that it's a process, that we need to work on character refinement, we need to work on this enthusiasm, this Beramayim Chaim. But we can't get discouraged. We need to dig and dig, and ultimately we'll be rewarded that we'll find the ever-flowing water.